This is Professor Allen, and welcome to the Quarter Bin. In every episode of this podcast, I will summarize, criticize, discuss, and review a single issue from my comic book collection, which I will select at random. Any book from my comic book collection is eligible, as long as I paid no more than 25 cents for it. Was the issue worth 25 cents? Was it a bargain at 25 cents? Or was it still overpriced? Stay tuned and find out. For this 66th episode of the Quarterman Podcast, we're looking at the final part of a six-issue miniseries, Tail Gunner Joe, number 6, from DC Comics, cover dated January 1989. I'm recording a handful of these episodes over my Christmas break in quick succession, so episode 65 has not exactly been released yet, so there's no Quarterman feedback. But I do have feedback for a couple of oddball episodes I did last year that I was never really able to address the comments for, and those are the music episodes. I talked about Richard Wagner's music, some of which is playing under this right now. On an episode of Relatively Geeky Presents, Count Druncula himself, Ryan Daly, commented on the dashed hopes he had listening to the start of that episode. I figured it was too much to ask that top 10 Wagnerian jams would refer to the comic book work of Matt Wagner. I almost shut this podcast off in disgust. But then he pulled me back with maybe the funniest, craziest thing I've ever heard on a podcast in 5 years. So if you're listening to this podcast and you happen to be pregnant, this is where you put the headphones on your belly. Well done, sir. Thank you, Ryan. And as far as I know, no female, woman, person of ladiness has yet to take that awesome medical advice. And Gene Hendricks, from the Hammer Strikes and the Quantum Cast, and also one of the many people whose musical episodes inspired that one, wrote in. Oh, inspired, by the way? Yeah, that was the legal defense I used when Gene and Tom and Andy and Michael and all the others, you know, sued me for stealing their idea. Anyway, water under the bridge, that settlement was months ago. Gene wrote in to say, Professor Allen, welcome to a very distinguished group of podcasters, which I say only because I'm part of it. As someone who grew up in a house where classical music was heard as often as rock and roll, I really enjoyed your most recent Relatively Geeky Presents show. I've noticed your use of various classical pieces on the Quarter Bin. Like you, I prefer the instrumental version of the pieces, Bugs Bunny notwithstanding. Although, if I'm in the right mindset, I can enjoy an opera too. Much like Shakespeare, it takes me a few minutes to click into how to experience it. But once I'm there, it's great. Gene. P.S. And now I have Kill the Wabbit stuck in my head. Thanks a lot, Professor. It is sad to think that for kids these days, their only exposure to classical music may well be Bugs Bunny reruns and the Quarter Bin podcast. I also did an episode of Long Play with Michael Bailey, where we, of course, talked about Meatloaf's album, Bat Outta Hell, songs by Jim Steinman. That was over on the 2-2 Freaks network. But with the rotating casts of hosts on that show, there's no way to really do feedback. Until now. Luke Giaconetti, one of the founders of the long play concept, wrote in about that episode. Being born in 1980, I was much more familiar with Meatloaf from his famous comic book ads for the Special Olympics than his music. It was not until I Would Do Anything for Love, But I Won't Do That, that I heard one of his songs knowing that it was him. And even then I never delved into his music, so to hear the history and backstory of this album was really enlightening. The collaborative aspects of Meatloaf and Jim Stein were fascinating to hear about. I have a bigger interest in the business side of music over the last decade or so, and this was great stuff to listen to. As for the music itself, the pomp and grandeur does add a sense of importance to the proceedings. This reminds me of the same sort of operatic songwriting we get from epic German metal, as well as compositions we might see from more contemporary prog rock acts. I'm thinking Deep Purple or the Alan Parsons Project. And hearing you guys both gush over it was a real treat. So I'm definitely going to have to give this album a spin in the near future. When Chris Honeywell and I were developing this podcast idea, one of my goals for the show was to expose listeners to music they might not have thought to seek out otherwise. So I'm very happy to have that happen here for me. Thanks, and keep on rockin', Luke. Now that was about 6 months ago as I record this, and Luke and I since then have gotten together to record an episode of Long Play about one of the acts he mentioned. The Turn of a Friendly Card by the Alan Parsons Project. Check those out at twotruefreaks.com. Thanks, of course, for all the feedback, everybody. But enough about music. We're here to talk about funny books. And I want to start with how I came to pick this comic, Tail Gunner Joe number 6. And it was pretty random. We've just wrapped up the new Universe miniseries, which I did to coincide with the new Starbrand and Night Mask book. And then we've got an X-Files issue I picked to go along with the TV revival of that show. So I figured it was time to do a flat-out random selection for this episode. So, on my most recent trip to the quarter bin sale at In the Ballpark, I decided that I would just grab a book from a long box at random. And that would be the book for this episode. I wandered in, I turned right, drifted over to a reasonable-looking long box, and about halfway back, I picked this one. It seemed reasonable as it was a DC book I'd never heard of. As a matter of fact, I was so unaware of it that until I dug through the book a bit and examined the indicia, I thought the book was titled Tail Gunner 10. In my defense, the title font is a bit stylized. But now that I know the actual title of the book, I can say that Tail Gunner Joe, number 6, had a cover price of $1.25, meaning I acquired this book at a solid 80% discount. The cover, by Tom Artis and Joe Rubinstein, shows a cute little blonde girl in a cute blue dress, think Alice in Wonderland. She's staring right at us, facing down a pair of much bigger, well-armed, scary beings of some kind. The words War and Heaven appear in a kind of neon script. The story, which is in fact titled War in Heaven, was written by Peter B. Gillis. The issue was penciled by Tom Artis and inked by the three-headed monster of Kim DeMolder, Alvey, and Pam Eklund. This is part 6 of 6 of a mini, so I do feel I need to give you listeners an advantage that I did not have in reading this book for the first time. And that is to give you a little background on the series, a little context for this final chapter. So here's a combination of the brief synopses of issues 1 through 5 from ComicVine.com, edited by me. Cyborg battles, deadly market research, strange strategic planning. These are all part of the world of Tail Gunner Joe. In a future time, the corporate world is going to war, and they're going to start coming for your bodies, as well as your minds. Take the case of Joe, a young girl with severe birth defects, born to a pair of super-smart scientific researchers for Telemachus, one of the two highly competitive megacorporations. After a mysterious accident, the mother, and I'm going to call her Marie, though it's spelled somewhat oddly, performs a strange experimental surgery on the pair, not knowing her patient's identities. The father is transformed into a cyborg, although in street clothes he can't pass for human. And young Joe becomes his tail gunner, watching their collective rear and operating the special cyborg weapons array. This is the double star weapon that the parents were developing. She is a very moral 10-year-old and hates killing, but does what she must to survive and to find her mother. Because after the surgery, the mother was disappeared by the corporation. Joe then is forced to live in two worlds. One is an Alice in Wonderland-style fantasy realm created by her father. His software creates a virtual fairyland world for her, complete with endless luncheons, dinners, and picnics, talking animals, their princesses, and heroes. The other world is the harsh reality of savage corporate warfare, warfare that's destroying the father's mind. And her two worlds quickly begin to meld together, leaving her confused and in danger. The father, Lars, and Joe flee from Telemachus. But no matter how far they run, there will never be a way out of their father and daughter forced symbiosis. and Joe's fairy tale companions mysteriously start to die. Joe's dad, Lars, is going madder by the minute, but Joe's trapped with him in a cyborg body as they take a harrowing 22,300-mile elevator ride to the orbiting satellite platform called Heaven. And that brings us to issue 6. I have to find Daddy. I know I have to find Daddy, but that's crazy. Daddy can't be in my world, and in the outside world, I can't be anywhere but inside the machine with Daddy. But which world is this? Joe is running through a corridor having this internal monologue and finds a huge door. I've got to get through, but I can't. I'm just a little. And then the door schwacks open, and she faces a golden gate inscribed with the word Heaven on it and the words You Made It above. And Joe thinks exactly what I thought at this point. I think this has just gotten a whole lot weirder. Within the gates is a Greek-style, Olympus-style set of buildings, and a huge orange cyborg death machine firing power blasts. Joe panics, but then she decides to try something. Thinking that her operating system is messed up, she realizes she might still be in the cyborg. She tries an energy blast of her own, but only manages a sparkle from her cute little 10-year-old hands. It does open a door, and she runs through it, because she has to get out of the open space. Oh. She still seems to be outside and finds creepy women who scream at her and a walking teddy bear in a black and white checkered outfit with a big old laser pulse rifle that is almost as big as Joe, and the bear gives Joe the weapon. She fires at a pair of flying attackers and flees right into her allies, a few more talking animals, and a green-skinned boy. As bullets fly, a door appears out of nowhere, right next to Joe. Joe, she hears. You've got to go through. You've got to. And she finds herself in a high-tech surgical suite. And the female doctor performing strange operations is... Mommy? Mommy? But Marie seems confused as to who this is, assuming that it's her husband. Obviously, she is seeing the cyborg, although we're seeing Joe in her little girl form. Marie crumbles in a heap. I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. She does recover enough to warn Joe to get out of there. They have firepower here to take out a squad of double stars. I wish you could destroy that abomination of a ship. Joe says she has to find her father, and Marie goes ballistic. Where is he? What did he do to him? He's not with you now? Oh God, he's dead. He must be. Joe flees her mother in search of her father. She hears via the intercom that her mom has set the ship for self-destruct. In a corridor, she runs into her friend Inez, who can't be there, and then who shows her an image of a hanged man, which transforms into her father Lars? There's much confusion for a page, for Joe, for Lars, and for me. And then, as the self-destruct warnings increase, Joe concentrates enough that she can actually see some images of the real world. And they dive into the last remaining escape pod. Lars, Joe, and a bunch of her talking animal friends. And just in the nick of time, Marie jumps through the breach. Lars, I think we have a chance at restoring you and Joe. I think I can make it up to you both, but we've got to leave. Now. But first, Joe wants to have a picnic with Teddy and all the heroic animals. We did it, Daddy. We won, and we're all together again. The end.
Black Canary.
I'll need a sparring partner.
About some leggy dame in nylons? Or have I answered my own question? Ladies and gentlemen, it's time for magic.
Black Canary and Zatanna. Together in one podcast. Power of Fishnets. Hosted by Ryan Daly. Coming in 2016. Thank you.
And we're back. DC had a weekly checklist in their books in this era, and there was a complicated series of symbols to describe each book. From what I can tell, there were four distinct formats that the books came in, ranking from worst to best. This is the second from the bottom. You had books in standard format, then the new format, deluxe, and then at the top of the heap, prestige format. This title is in the new format, meaning it was on slightly higher quality paper, not glossy, just a little better than the usual newsprint. Fewer ads, perhaps a better coloring process. For context, other books on sale this month in DC's standard format were cover priced at 75 cents, while this was $1.25. This book also contains the notation suggested for mature readers, and does not contain a Comics Code approval seal. On the mature readers and Comics Code, it's not that I skipped over stuff in the synopsis, you know, just didn't comment on all the nudity and the cursing, because there wasn't any. This is actually mature in the way that I kind of appreciate my comic books being mature. It was emotionally mature. The storytelling was certainly complex. The high concept was certainly complex. Maybe it's just the confusing contrasts that make it necessary to warn young kids away from this, because at times there are sickly sweet images straight from children's fantasy stories. But there's also action that is as gory and violent as it can be. The similarities to Alice in Wonderland are not coincidental, and they develop a world here that is almost as nonsensical and confusing as what Alice found. For one thing, the entire issue is told from Joe's virtual reality point of view, I guess, and she's a confused and disabled 10-year-old. So it's not always easy to tell exactly what's happening. But I don't think that plot was the main thing that this comic series was about. It was about feel. It was about vibe. It was about being weird. And I don't necessarily bristle at weird. In context, in the right setting, weird can work for me. Look, I like Twin Peaks. I don't mind weird or whimsical or wacky. But I do like consistency and sense as well. On the same day that I nabbed this one from the cheap bins, I also picked up the first five issues of Peter Milligan's Shade the Changing Man, from basically the same era. Emily was with me, and she knew the reputation of Shade the Changing Man as one of the weirder, more bizarre characters or titles in DC's history. My joke was that Shade's power was to alter reality, and I wonder if being altered was critical to writing it, or maybe even reading it. So I was planning on sitting down in a few days and taking a shot at what I knew was a weird, nutty story, that Shade title. But after reading this one, I think I might have to clear my head a bit before heading on to Shade. I also have all 12 issues of Thriller, one of the most notoriously hard-to-follow, weird comics ever. But like I said, I might need to clear my head a bit before tackling either of those. The Shade books, by the way, I did get for a quarter each. So it's not out of the question that I will talk about them on some future episode here. Again, weird for weird's sake is not what I'm really about, but weird with a purpose, confusing with a point, I don't mind that. And it seems like that's the setup here, that this is so high concept, that I thought the confusion did have a point. First, it has a narrative point, because like I said, it was from a confused young person's point of view. And we did have two worlds happening, two worlds, very different worlds that sometimes crossed over with each other. So I think the weirdness was earned. I'm okay with it as weirdness. This also seemed a very non-American style of comic book, like it belonged somewhere else. There was nothing in the art to make me think of manga or anime, but I do get that kind of vibe from it. But maybe also a European sensibility. That's somewhat what I associate the odd and the nonsensical with. But I kept leaning a little more towards manga. It's such a full and complete world that I actually wondered at first if this was actually based on a pre-existing property. So I was assuming a Japanese property, but that doesn't seem to be the case. Maybe it's that it has aspects of giant robot stories, or mechs, that is leading me down that direction. And yes, when I realized that this was a two-person robot suit working with some sort of telepathic link, I also thought of Pacific Rim. So maybe, again, that's where I'm getting more Asian than Euro in terms of the references and inspirations for this. But I'm guessing it's a little bit of both. And the writer, Peter Gillis, has some history with the off-kilter. He wrote Mars and Warp and Shatter, all for First Comics in the mid-80s. I read some of Mars and remember it being an out-there sci-fi book. And I read a lot of Shatter, but only have vague recollection of it. But again, of it being a bit out of the norm. After this, after Tail Gunner Joe, he went right into Gamma Rotters for a year or so, which was pretty much the end of his active career writing comics. Back to this story itself. I'm choosing to interpret the ending as reality, which I realize is a choice that I'm making. It could just as easily be seen that this is the final stages of Joe's fantasy world, and that this is not how it really ended. But taking it at face value, we do end on a hopeful note. The family is reunited, and Dr. Mom thinks that somehow she can restore her husband and daughter back to normal bodies. But that is such a happy ending that I'm suspicious. That seems like a happily ever after that a 10-year-old would come up with, where everything works out perfectly. And that didn't totally fit the tone of the book. So it's definitely open-ended. It is an ending that is subject to interpretation, and a more pessimistic ending is also, I think, a totally valid reading of this. But I love family reunification stories, and, no surprise, I have a particularly soft spot for father-daughter stories with happy endings. So as unusual and as untrustworthy as the storytelling was, as the visuals were, I'm choosing to believe the happy ending. And of course, you know, we're rooting for this ending. It's not that it's out of the blue. But if you think about her future, the family's future, the world's future, it's still pretty bleak from this point going forward. It's not going to be easy for her in any form. The mother is talking about separating Joe from the double star, but what about her physical limitations and handicaps? Judging from just this issue, I don't know exactly what those limitations are. I don't even know the extent to which they were discussed in earlier issues in terms of what her specific handicaps are. But it's going to be tough on her no matter what. But what we do know, what we've learned in these issues, is that she's resilient, she's a fighter, she can cope. So I think it's not too far out of the question to at least consider that this story might, in fact, have a happy ending. The verdict on Tail Gunner Joe number 6. You know, in general, it might be easier to read the first issue of a miniseries or an arc and judge it. Mostly you can decide, yes, I'd like to read the next issue and see where this goes. As opposed to reading the final issue of a miniseries or arc. And if you don't know everything that came first, it's kind of hard to judge how well they did in wrapping up the story. On the excellent podcast, Writing Excuses, they talk about promises that authors make to readers and how the storyteller's job is to fulfill those promises. And not having the first 5 issues of this, having just a few paragraphs of synopses from the internet, I don't know what promises were made, so I can't say whether they were fulfilled. So all I have is what I have in front of me, and that is one wacky, crazy issue of comic book adventure, and one that gives us an ending at least. Open-ended, subject to interpretation, but there is an ending. Again, we can choose which interpretation we want, but we do get to the end of this miniseries, and it does seem to end, and that's worth something. If you can find all 6 of these, or at least more than just the last one, and if you don't mind that feeling of being lost in a story, or reading a story that's intending to confuse you, take a shot at it. If you're a bit adventurous in your reading, and if you can pick up this issue with at least a few others from the run, then yeah, it could be a quarter bin deal. That wraps up my coverage of Tail Gunner Joe number 6, bringing episode 66 of the Quarter Bin Podcast to a close. And episode 67 will cover X-Files number 0, the official adaptation of the original TV pilot from Topps Comics, 1997. If you have any questions or comments about this issue, this episode, or the podcast, feel free to contact me. Until next episode, I'm Professor Allen, and I'll see you in the quarter bin. The Quarter Bin Podcast is part of the Relatively Geeky family of podcasts. Show notes and links are available at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com, where the podcasts Uncovering the Bronze Age and Short Box Showcase also make their home. Links to Facebook and Twitter are there as well. Feedback for the show is welcome at relativelygeeky@gmail.com. And if you like what we've got going here, please leave a review and a rating in iTunes. It'll help more people discover the show. Thanks again for listening. Professor!